Welcome to My Musical Journey, where our guests choose significant music in their life's musical journey.
On My Musical Journey today, we welcome guest presenter Kathy Selby from our sister station, 2MBS Fine Music in Sydney. Kathy is speaking with John Bell, AO, OBE and Fellow of the Royal Society of New South Wales. This acclaimed actor, theatre director and theatre manager has been a major influence on the development of Australian theatre in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, in particular through the Bell Shakespeare Company, of which Bell was for so long artistic director. In this conversation, recorded in the studios of 2MBS in Sydney, Kathy commenced by asking John Bell about his relationship with Shakespeare's ultimate tragic figure, Hamlet.
Well, I've directed it twice before. Mm. I've played Hamlet twice, first for the Old Tote Company back in 1963, and then for the Nimrod. Mm. I did it at the Nimrod in 1972 with Richard Werrett co-directing with me. And I was also in it at Stratford-on-Avon back in 1965, 66. That was Peter Hall's production with David Warner playing Hamlet. And we did that for three seasons. It was a very popular production too. But I've known it off by heart since I was about 14, I think. I've just lived with this play all my life. And I've seen it countless times on film, on stage, television, you name it. And it's still a profound mystery.
How do you put contemporary against the old-fashioned language that Shakespeare originally wrote in? How do you rationalise putting it in a 20th century or 21st century format and still keeping the language that Shakespeare wrote?
You have to create a world, I think. You can't just recreate or imitate an existing world, whether it's Elizabethan or contemporary. Mm-hmm. It has to be a universe that you fantasize and create that's a little bit like the world we know, enough to identify with, but a bit different as well. So you can have ghosts and poisoned cups and poisoned swords and kings and queens. So it's familiar and yet a bit exotic.
Being the director and not the performer, you're like a coach.
Yes.
How do you pull the best out of your performers rather than, I imagine you've met many directors and experienced them who subjugate you with their will.
Yes, that's not so pleasant.
No, I can imagine.
It's the old-fashioned way, I think, but it's still practiced a bit in England and parts of Europe. And do it like me, do it like this, which is a very deadening thing, and nobody can give their best if they're merely imitating or, impersonating somebody. I think the first clue is casting. You try to cast people who you think have it in them and want to reveal what's there. If someone is miscast, it means either they haven't got the quality you thought they had, or they cannot or refuse to show it, something inhibiting. And I think any actor can be miscast. There are certain qualities that they just simply cannot conjure up. But once you've cast it, hopefully satisfactorily, then I suppose you don't bludgeon a performance out of somebody. You try to evoke it by throwing little challenges and encouragements. And you know the actor wants to give their best. Some people, though, are shy about that, and they will appear disgruntled or bad-tempered or grumpy, and that's often a disguise for nervousness. So you have to be able to read that and think they're not really grumpy, they're just scared.
I've
just got to coach them through this and get them through it and let them reveal what's there.
But isn't that what they learn as an actor, is how to project whatever they're feeling? And
yeah, but they are people too, and they're frightened of failure, and age doesn't help. You can still be getting on into your senior years and still frightened, even perhaps more frightened of failure than you were when you were younger.
I remember something I read in your book, by the way. It's a wonderful book, John Bell, The Time of My Life. I love particularly what you said about John Gielgud, that particularly where it relates now to, it doesn't matter how old you are or how experienced you are, you can still be scared asking you, was I okay tonight?
Yes.
I mean, that was wonderful.
Yeah.
Have you ever actually miscast somebody and then been shocked?
Oh, yes. Couple of times, because some people can audition for you terribly well.
Yeah.
They're very impressive in an audition, but that's their party piece. That's all they can do.
Oh, I see.
And you get them into a rehearsal room and they've done it.
Fall
that's
apart.
All that's all they've got to offer, and they won't or can't go any further. Or they can be quite, some people, and I've only met this once or twice in my career, thank heavens, but they can be quite difficult and intractable and not pleasant to work with.
Yeah.
And that doesn't show in an audition. Once they've got the gig, then the bad side gets revealed. Until then, they're as charming as pie. And that's a bit of a nightmare, not just for the director, but for the whole company. And if they're on tour for 6 months, it can become a real
disaster.
Problem.
Yeah. Can I introduce the first piece that you've chosen?
Why don't we start with maybe Bach cello?
Okay. Is there something special particularly about this?
Well, yes, several things. I did a play many years ago at the Nimrod called Variations, and it was a play with music written by Nick Enright and Terence Clarke, and it employed a string quartet, and the Bach cello featured in that, and Nick gave me a box set of the recordings as a first night gift, which I'm very, very fond of. Mm. But when I listen to the Bach cello suites, it's utterly timeless. It might be called Baroque, it might be 18th century, but I can't put a time on that music. It's absolutely, it could be yesterday, it could be a jazz musician just improvising. Mm. It's got a wonderful freedom about it. And I do love the cello, I think, more than any other instrument. It just really gets to me deep down, yeah.
Thank you.
I'd love to talk about actually getting on stage, whether you have nerves, stage fright, whether there's still a sense of impending doom, whether you have nightmares, whether you've got a favourite nightmare that's recurred year after year after year.
Yes, to all of the above. You got it in one. I do get stage fright still. On first nights, it's almost unbearable. You feel sick with nerves.
Yeah.
And you think, this is stupid. I've rehearsed the part. I know it feels right. The rest of the cast is good. The show feels good. People have come to see it because they want to be here. They've paid money to see this.
Yeah.
They're not going to hate it. But the fear of failure, I guess, is just almost overwhelming. And thereafter, every night, I feel a little buzz of nerves just before I go on. And if I didn't do that, I think I'd give up. I think it's so important. It's a frisson of anticipation and, you know, you want to do your best, make it better than last night.
Absolutely.
It's absolutely necessary. And I think it'd be awfully dull if you didn't have that. There'd be no point in doing it, frankly.
No.
You need that sense of get out there and sock it to them, you know.
You're standing on the edge.
Absolutely.
Do you think you have to be a particular kind of personality to walk out on stage and bear it all like that?
I think you do. I think you do.
Can that be learned, or is that something that's innate?
Not really. I think it's the urge, the instinct is there. The want to do that has to be there. And it's not just an ego thing. It's you want to show people something, you want to create something, you want to please people. It can be quite a selfless thing. It's not just an ego trip.
Yeah.
I still do have nightmares when I'm directing, particularly just before the opening night. I'll have about a week of them.
What kind of nightmares?
Oh, how do we get the elephants on from stage right? There's such a small entrance there.
And are there elephants in the play?
Of course not. But that's what a nightmare is. You know, the most absurd things. You make up thinking, what elephants? And as an actor, I'm afraid my worst nightmare is I know all my lines, but nobody else knows theirs. Now, there's an ego trip for you. And being in a one-man show, I only done it once. I didn't enjoy it. It's very lonely up there, and there's no one to bounce off, no one to play with. I much prefer to be part of a group.
When in your book you describe this wonderful story of being Lord Byron,
yeah,
I think it was.
Yeah.
Where was that?
Oh, well, we opened at the Adelaide Festival. No, I forget what year it was now.
This was a one-man show?
Yeah, Ron Blair wrote it for me, a one-man play about Byron, mad, bad and dangerous to know, based on his letters and diaries. But I never got into it. I never really liked Byron, and that's a great problem. You can't play somebody if you don't like them.
Really?
I really hated him, I'm afraid.
You really can't play someone?
No, you can't. You have to empathise, like them, want to inhabit them. And if you have that sense of judging somebody or disapproving, you can't do it.
Yeah.
You just cannot do it. So I never got on with Lord Byron, I'm afraid. Much as I admire his poetry, I didn't like the man. So that was not pleasant. But then we toured it all up through regional Queensland for some reason. Mad thing to do. But which story are you thinking of?
I love the one where you...
About the parrots?
Yes,
ah,
the drunk parrots.
The drunk parrots.
How did you concentrate with all these crazy drunk parrots falling
on
the ground?
Oh, I couldn't concentrate. I think it was Rockhampton or Townsville, I forget which, but it was an 11 o'clock show in the morning for school kids, God help them, about 1,000 of them packed into the town hall, and I was up there being Lord Byron, and one side of the hall was just glass looking out onto the footpath, so we couldn't have a blackout or, you know, the lighting was ineffective, the sunlight poured in. And the footpath was lined with these great big trees. I don't know what sort of trees they were, some sort of tropical things with little red berries all over them. And I started at 11 o'clock as Byron. About 11:05, the parrots arrived and squawking and cheering and got into the trees and got stuck into the berries. And then for the next half hour, the parrots would plummet from the trees with a sort of a drunken squawk and go splat on the footpath. And I was absolutely mesmerised. I couldn't take my eyes off this, you know, like blitz of raining parrots. The kids were totally oblivious to it. They were probably quite used to it.
That's unbelievable.
But that was, I was very badly upstaged that day.
Well, they do say never to perform with pets and children,
well,
don't they?
Parrots, I warn you, right off.
I guess the other thing that is entirely important for an actor, particularly on the stage, is the projection of your voice,
mm-hmm.
and learning how to control that. How do you go about changing, for example, your voice? I mean, have Australian audiences wanted to hear the Australian accent much more over years? Or
yes.
That's a whole other question, but I mean...
Yes, they have. I think it was really when we started having Australian plays that that difference was made, because from until about the 70s, most of the plays we were doing were American or English. We didn't do many Australian plays. The notable hits like Summer of the 17th Doll and so on, mm. the rarities. But the 70s brought us a whole new generation of playwrights, and when you start doing Australian plays, then you have to use your Australian accent, your Australian voice,
yes.
and people found it wonderful to hear it on stage. Not just the accent, but the idiom and
yes,
the
yes.
humour, and, you know, all those early David Williamson plays particularly.
Yeah.
People were just absolutely thrilled by them. And so then once you do that, then you've found your own voice, then you start applying that to the classics and whatever you do. Because we were stuck with this dreadful tradition of you had to sound English on stage. You had
yes.
to, if you're doing Shakespeare especially, you had to imitate the English. You couldn't use an Australian voice, which was ridiculous. But now, of course, it's we have a rich variety of accents on stage, and I encourage actors to hang on to their accent, whether it's Polish or Italian mm. or Russian or whatever they happen to be. That's their voice, and you don't just change it for the sake of conforming.
Mm.
Your voice is very much who you are.
That's right. How do you, if you've got a tiny little voice, I mean, what is the technique that has to be employed?
Well, it's taken me a lifetime. I've had not much voice training when I was younger because I didn't go to drama school. And I've had a couple of dreadful voice teachers in my time and a couple of very, very good ones. And it's largely experience and relaxing and getting to know yourself and trust yourself. It's also just thinking towards the back row of the theatre. You just put your mind out there and your voice will follow. If you try to force it or squeeze it, then you're going to do damage and you're going to constrict it. It's really opening up the mind and the, you know. You say that people have small voices, but somebody whose house is on fire or the kid is going to get run over and they'll find a huge voice and yell. And think, where did that come from? It's there. We just don't often get in touch with it. Certainly actors need to work on their voice, but there are other ways of doing it. It's largely to do with breath and
yeah.
with focus and with articulation. Yes, the voice does mature. Like a muscle, it will develop.
Mm-hmm. How about some Mozart?
Well, let's go to Mozart.
Okay.
It'd be lovely. This is the Marriage of Figaro.
That's right. You've chosen the overture. And you didn't put down
who
you wanted.
I don't really mind. I think there are so many good versions of
okay.
that. Which one have you chosen?
The one I chose was an old recording of Furtwängler.
Uh-huh.
But I know that you did an opera.
Yes,
you
many,
Don
many
Giovanni.
Years ago. Yeah, yes.
You bet you didn't choose Don Giovanni for your choice today.
Well, I just love Marriage of Figaro
okay.
more than any other Mozart opera, I
yeah.
think.
Okay.
And the overture is the one piece, if I were given the chance to conduct a piece, and they said you can conduct
really?
Any orchestra, any piece what you want, I'd think, I'd say I want to conduct the overture to Marriage of Figaro.
And you'd like to do that?
I would like to do it.
Thank you.
Overture to the Marriage of Figaro by Mozart, performed there by Wilhelm Furtwängler and the Berlin Philharmonic, and the choice of my guest today, John Bell. When you walk out, do you look at the audience? Do you pick someone in the audience? Do you ignore them and play for yourself? Perform for yourself? Mm. Is it something that you teach people, or is it an individual thing for everybody, that they have some way of existing and surviving for those 3 or 4 hours on stage?
I would really encourage actors to look at the audience and look them in the eye and play to them. There's a difference between doing that and looking into the middle distance over their heads and soliloquizing.
For them too?
Yeah. If people look at you and make direct contact,
it's
very strong. Well, of course, we get that from Shakespeare's own theatre, that the actor walked out in broad daylight onto that empty space, and the audience were crammed all around in the globe, in the pit or sitting in those galleries at the site, and the actors would talk straight at them, straight to them, in a very, very direct, colloquial way. It wasn't grand or declamatory. It was very fast and colloquial kind of chat.
Yeah. And I love the way you described that whole hotbed of thieves.
And, oh, yes.
And that actors and
in the theatre
playhouses
district
were really quite degenerate at that time.
Yes.
So you think people just stood there and watched them?
Oh, they did, but people were used to standing. I mean, because many people couldn't read, it was a very oral society, and your life might depend on listening to a proclamation or a law case, or even a sermon. Your immortal soul could be in peril if you didn't get the sermon right. And so a sermon might last for 3 or 4 hours on a Sunday. That was quite common. And you could listen to lawyers talk all day. Your life might depend on what they were saying, and your understanding of language and tricks with language and complexities. So people, I think, were very much more aware of language, and they would listen to it and interpret it, more than we are today. Yeah. We're a much more visual society
very
now.
Visual.
To get things in sound bites is one of my least favourite phrases. So I think to stand and listen to a Shakespeare play for 2 or 3 hours would be no effort at all. I'd be totally used to that. And they would say, let's go hear a play, not see a play. Let's go hear a play,
really?
Was the common phrase, yeah.
What is the prevalent audience for Shakespeare these days?
Well, we try to cast a wide net. We do encourage young people through our ticket pricing. Anybody under 27 can come for $20, which is quite a good deal. And, of course, we play to a lot of school kids because a lot of them are there per force. Mm. They mightn't choose to be there. But I'd say that about a third of our audience is under the age of 30, which is quite
fantastic.
Good. And we encourage that because that's the audience for tomorrow. And I don't think we have as aging an audience as I see at the symphony or the opera or the ballet. Mm. I think those organisations have to be very wary about growing a new audience. Mm. But I think there is a very encouraging young audience for chamber music. And when I go to Macquarie Trio or the ACO, you see a lot of young people there, more than you find at the Sydney Symph, I think.
Do you find that your audiences are able to go the distance of a Hamlet and of a King Lear? And, I mean, are they able to, or do they start getting a bit restless and...
Not noticeably. I'm very conscious with a long play like Hamlet, which is less than 3 hours after all. Isn't that long, comparatively. That audiences are pretty rapt and pretty still. Mm. But that's because we do play it pretty quickly. We try not to leave any gaps. There's no scene changes. The play does bat along. It's a very fast-moving play, after
all.
It
is.
And it's very much my intention when I'm running the play, say at the end of 4 or 5 weeks rehearsal and we start running it in its totality, I have a stopwatch out and I say, we've got to knock another 2 or 3 minutes off. Yeah.
Really?
And between the first run of Hamlet and the second, we knocked off 15 minutes, just through the actors closing up the gaps, coming in on cue, keeping it moving, and that's, and it took on a whole new life when I did that. It suddenly sprang to life, yeah, rather than just plodding along, because you can rehearse all the scenes individually and, you know, get into a comfortable rhythm, but when you put it all together, it has to go like the clappers, without losing a word or losing any of the meaning or the sense of it. But it's written that way. I mean, yeah, Shakespeare wrote for actors to be on their feet, not sitting down thinking, but thinking while they're talking.
Do you find that venue plays an important part in how... Oh, you closed your eyes and breathed in, so I can see that you do.
I think a lot of our contemporary theatres are very sterile places and lacking an atmosphere and far too formal. And if I really had my druthers and someone said that you can build your own theatre, it would be something much rougher and more adaptable than the present buildings that we have. I'd love old warehouses and old buildings that have a, you know, informality about them. The first two theatres I was involved in here in Australia, the two Nimrod theatres, yes, one was an old stables in King's Cross, the other one is now the Belvoir in Surrey Hills, but they were both just converted, you know, garages and things.
Yes.
And you could do anything you liked in there, and the audience was very relaxed and very comfortable with that atmosphere. It wasn't the same kind of...
Is it more intimate? It's smaller?
It's more intimate, and you can do things in the interval and pre-show, and you can muck up a bit more, you know, which you can't do in places like the Opera House.
Mm.
It's quite formal, and that does impose a certain solemnity on the evening that I'd rather not have.
Yes. Okay, well, let's hear some more music. How about some Shostakovich? The Piano Concerto No. 2... Bernstein,
mm-hmm,
we have performing and conducting,
right,
in New York Phil,
right,
which is terrific. The first movement only. You love Shostakovich. You mention him in your book as,
yes,
an artist who's defined the 20th century.
One of those.
One of
has.
The artists.
Yes, yes.
Is that why you've chosen him?
I think so. He really inspires me, not just his music, which is wonderful. It's got that great classical bass, but, you know, modern passion, contemporary passion, and also knowing his own travails, all he went through, and how he managed to survive, which was very canny, and at the same time subvert the system and get away with it. I find that absolutely inspiring. And, you know, he's a great role model, I think, for any artist in adversity.
Shostakovich, Piano Concerto No. 2, first movement, performed by Leonard Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic.
Thank you.
Shostakovich Piano Concerto No. 2, performed there, that's the first movement, I should say, by Leonard Bernstein, conducting and performing with the New York Philharmonic. The choice of my very special guest, John Bell, today. I wanted to ask you how you relate music to drama. And you've obviously had a very strong connection to Australian composers.
Mm.
How do you figure out what kind of music you want for a production? And then how do you go about choosing the right person for it? And is this something you have in your mind already? You have a feeling for it? Yeah.
Yes, I generally do, but I don't ever tell the composer that unless
really?
They ask.
What, you want to give them complete freedom?
Yes. Although if they say, well, I'm not sure, what do you think, then I'll come up with something. Alan John has composed a number of scores for me. He's a great theatre composer and has a wide range of musical references. And when we talked about Hamlet, he said, well, what are you thinking of? And I said, well, just try this for size. I'm thinking of Shostakovich.
Yeah.
I explained why, because it has the classical bass plus this modern sort of astringency and urgency about it and the political connotations. That's where I was coming from, and he sort of took that on board. And he came back and said, well, how about a bit of Sibelius, a bit of Norwegian fiddle? He came back with some other references, and so we ended up with an amalgam of, And also I said, I want something a bit grand, Pretorius or something, for the court entrances and the players' entrance. Mm. So we both happened to have the same collection of Pretorius, so he knew what ones I was talking about, and he did a bit of that for me as well. But frequently, I'll say, with designers too, I won't say exactly what I want. I'll have a whole lot of ideas, but I say, well, what do you think? And let them float some ideas to me. And if their ideas are better, I'd grab them. But if they haven't got an idea or it doesn't appeal, I'll say, well, I see it more this way. And then we'll do a bit of, horse trading. The next stage of my life will be in more and more in mentoring younger people and getting them to take on more of what I'm doing. So it survives me and spreads and keeps on spreading. I mean, and that's a delightful prospect because I know that talent is there in all those young people, and it's a great privilege to be able to give them the chance to use it.
Well, on that note, I think that we'll play your last selection. This is the Beethoven Piano Concerto No. 1, and we have Ashkenazi here with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra and Zubin Mehta. And we're going to play the rondo from this. Is there something about this piece in particular?
I think for quite a few years I got hooked on Baroque music and rather neglected the Romantics. And it's only in the last few years I've come back to appreciate the real genius of Beethoven and Mahler and Strauss. And, I went through a stage of being a bit more astringent about music and loving the purity of Baroque and of Bach particularly. But you come across Beethoven and you think, my God, there was only one Beethoven, and what a wild and turbulent genius that was.
Before we listen, I'd like to personally thank you so much. I've just so enjoyed sitting here and chatting to you. I feel like saying, please, everybody stand up and applaud.
You may.
That's right.
In the privacy of your own home.
That's right.
Thank you.
That was Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1 with Ashkenazy and the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra under Zubin Mehta. On My Musical Journey, Kathy Selby from 2MBS in Sydney has been speaking with one of Australia's living treasures, John Bell, this country's most informed and respected Shakespearean actor and director. The 2021 4MBS Brisbane Shakespeare Festival, with a fully costumed and professionally acted performance of Macbeth, gets underway on Sunday, the 24th of October, at Sandgate, and the following weekend, the 30th and 31st of October, at Roma Street, Parklands. Performances are free, but our COVID-safe plan requires that you register your seat requirements in advance. All details are on our website, 4mbs.com.au. But please, save the dates for the 2021 4MBS Brisbane Shakespeare Festival at Sandgate, Sunday the 24th of October, and the Roma Street Parklands Amphitheatre on the weekend of the 30th and 31st of October.
You have been listening to My Musical Journey.